Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Gig Stories podcast with me and my wee Scottish friend, Christopher Payne. How are you, lovely man?
I'm very well. I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm doing okay.
I'd take okay all day long.
Okay, okay. No, at the moment.
Yeah.
We don't want to get into the miseries of life, do we? But what we want to get into is the great extended dog walk I had this morning, because listener, it's a Friday when we record this, and Friday is new album day.
You've got a new album out?
Yes, I have.
the difficult 14th album.
Exactly. But we'll talk more about this at the end of the episode. It was a good Friday, new music Friday, and that was exciting.
Oh, so you were walking and you were listening to a new album?
Absolutely, and again, we'll mention that after. We'll mention it after, because listener, we're cutting these intros down so that we can get straight into the good stuff,
straight to the meat.
Exactly, and if that's how you want to refer to this week's guest, please do, because it is the temptation. The temptation, Chris, to introduce this guest. And we didn't say it to him, respectfully.
Yeah, we talked about the single, but we didn't use any music-based puns.
Because we are better than that. We are better than that.
Well, so, I am.
It's a great chat. Enjoy it. It is the one and only Chesney Hawkes.
You couldn't resist it, could you?
On the Gig Stories podcast, Chesney, we are, no matter who we're speaking to, we like to go back, because it's always interesting to us to find out people's sort of musical backgrounds and how they fell in love with music, and then, of course, specifically live music. Now, you are quite unique within the many guests we've had. You have a very sort of musical background. Obviously, if people don't know, your father was in the Tremolos. So do we assume then that growing up as a youngster, music was forced upon you?
I wouldn't say forced, but it was ubiquitous.
Yeah.
You know, it was everywhere. It was life, you know.
All of my dad's
mates were, you know, musicians, and a lot of them were, you know, superstars like Jerry Marsden, you know, The Searchers, The Marmalade, Herman's Hermits, Dave D, Dozy Beaky, Mick and Titch were all dad's mates.
Amazing.
And so my upbringing was very, very much kind of, you know, being around those people. There were, you know, guitars propped up in every corner. We owned John Lennon's piano. That's another story. That is, we lived in a town called Sunningdale in Berkshire, and I was born in 71, and John Lennon owned he lived in Sunningdale up to 73 74, something like that, in a big place called Tittenhurst Park.
Right,
it's where, if you ever seen the Imagine video where John and Yoko walking around the gardens and he's playing the white piano, that's Tittenhurst Park. And one day my dad was working at the studio, recording at the studio on the grounds of Titmuss Park. John had just sold the place to Ringo, so it must have been about 73, 74, and he'd moved to New York. And so it was in the process of moving over from one Beatle to another. And he came to work, and there was a piano outside in the rain. This beautiful, like, baby grand piano. And
really?
And my dad was like, said to the engineer when he came in, why is there a piano out in the rain? And he said, oh, that was Ringo's. It was John's, and Ringo doesn't want it. So, you know, he's just put it out there for now.
Wow.
As you do when you're a Beatle. So basically my dad ended up like taking it. Like, he didn't steal it. It was apparently Ringo was like, no, if you know someone that wants a piano. So my dad literally, this is a true story, went and got a transit van and a few mates, backed it up on the lawn of Titner's Park, put the piano in the back, and drove it off home to us. That's the piano that I learned to play on.
Wow.
I still own it. We still own it.
Really? Yeah.
It was in my childhood, in our childhood front room throughout my whole childhood. And then mum and dad moved out of that house and I inherited that. And my kids, you know, learned to play on it. It was in our front room for 10 years or so. And then I moved to the States. And I was like, what the hell am I going to do with John Lennon's piano? So it's now sitting in Nick Kershaw's front room. So he's got it on permanent loan, you know.
That's hilarious.
No.
So what period was this that Lennon had it? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what he wrote on that.
Here's the thing. I don't know when he bought it or when he acquired it. I just know that 73 was probably the time that he it was inherited to Ringo.
Right.
So
okay.
It could have been, you know, the 5-6 years before that. So it would have been, oh God, I guess early Lennon solo stuff.
Wow.
But apparently, see, I've done a lot of research on this. I can't prove it. See, I can't do any much proof of it. So, you know, there are lots of other pianos in Tittenhurst Park as well. So it's not like, it's not the white piano, you know.
it's just
a piano. So,
but still, I would make sure Kershaw looks after it, you know.
Yeah, he's been looking after it. He's been getting it tuned. And so, although, you know, we'll see. I'm going over to see Nick recently in a couple of weeks. I'll be like, I'm going to go check on my little baby.
So what, now I know your dad was in the Tremolos, but growing up, was it always that kind of music that was on? Or were your mum and dad actually playing all kinds? You know, who were the artists that you remember? Oh, mum and dad playing these.
A lot of Beatles. My dad, I remember, you know, discovering my dad's vinyl collection at an early age. And there was a definite half and half with my dad's and my mum's. And my dad was like, you know, Elvis Presley, and then kind of rock and roll, early rock and roll, Gene Vincent. You know, Teddy Boy stuff as well, but like 12 Bar Blue mainly stuff, you know. And then there would be like Beatles, Kinks, Stevie Wonder, you know, all that kind of, you know, great. And then, you know, Beats, Invasion stuff, like I was saying before, like a lot of Searches and Marmalade and that kind of thing.
When did the guitar come along then?
Well, much later. I mean, I always kind of like picked up a guitar and dabbled, but I was always keys, always a piano player right through my whole teens, really. I would say I probably seriously picked it up when I got the part in Buddy's Song, probably age 17, because I have memories of when I did, you know, the auditions and got through the audition process, and then it started to get serious, and I was like, oh, I better actually learn a few things on this guitar, because I've told them I can play guitar.
It's like the typical actor's CV where you're horse rider. Yeah, I'm a competent horse rider.
Exactly. And actually, there's a good story behind this one too. You're exactly right, Chris. So at the screen test, it was down to me and one other guy.
Who was the other guy?
His name was Cal, and I've lost touch. All right, okay. We were like rivals, but friends back in the day. You know, he was a nice kid.
Yeah.
And God knows what he's doing now. But it was the two of us came to do a scene with Roger, which was like an emotional scene where he ended up slapping me, and it was like all tears and everything. And then I had to play guitar and sing on the stage where the Who were rehearsing. So I remember going up there with this guitar around my neck and having that kind of out of body experience, thinking, what is this thing around my neck?
God. You were living that kind of nightmare that you have. You're on stage and you don't know what you're playing, but you were actually doing it.
Dad had taught me how to play like a few chords, really. But I mean, I was competent. I did. Well, that's all right, Mama. You know, because the film was based around kind of Teddy Boy music. I was named after Buddy Holly, and you know, and so I got on stage and I started playing it. And I looked across and all I could see was I'm on this huge stage with like Simon Phillips drums back here and like, you know, everything was massive. And it was a very, very high stage. And I looked at the back of the room, on the kind of floor there were all the producers, Roger Daltrey, my dad, a few other people. And then behind, right back at the back of the room, with his arms folded like this, just leaning up against the wall like that, is fucking Pete Townsend.
Good, and go on, son. Make my day.
Just, yeah, exactly that. Like, go on, impress me then, young kid. And that's when I really realized, as I was like, okay, so I'm playing this guitar that I don't know how to play in front of one of the greatest guitar players and most iconic guitar players of all time. And also happens to be like an absolute idol for me as a songwriter. And and so I just started off doing it. And then, I started kind of like moving a little bit and singing and stuff and getting into it a bit. And then I saw Roger start walking across the floor. And I was like, where's he going? He's not listening. And he walked off. And then I saw him go to the stairs, and I'm kind of like half playing and half what's he doing? He walked up the stairs, and he got on the stage, and I'm still playing, and he walked up right up to me, and he grabbed my leg. He goes, "Stop moving your fucking leg!"
Brilliant.
I thought I'd blown it.
Yeah,
but apparently I didn't.
Oh my God! So did your dad? I'm assuming your dad knew Daltrey and Townsend, that, or were they kind of slightly different?
He said that he had toured with them, you know, back in the 60s at some point. He did a tour with them and Traffic, apparently. The band, oh, right. Remember the band Traffic?
Yeah, Stevie Winwood.
Steve Winwood. So it was, yeah, that's right. My dad's got some good Steve Winwood stories. You should interview my dad. Oh, no, you can't now, really. He's just not so well these days. But he had all the stories. Oh, but yes, so he did tell, he did actually meet Roger back then. But that's not how it all came about. I went through the whole audition process, you know. But
can you imagine that? When your first live appearance is on stage, in essentially on the Who's stage, in front of the Who. Because this is all about live music, it is without doubt one of the cheesiest things I've ever seen, but it is absolutely, it was euphoric, and I lost my head. And it was only in 2000 and maybe 2001, and the Who announced a one-off gig at Cardiff Arena. And it was a warm up for something like the Isle of Wight or something. And I was all over that. So I'm there, and it's the usual setup, big old stage, waiting. It was Zach Starkey on drums.
And Zach's an old friend of mine. I've known him for years.
Oh, really? He's probably in my top four drummers.
Yeah, he's a monster.
Live drummers. He's ridiculous.
He's also a really great guitar player. He used to play guitar in a band when my brother was the drummer. Yeah, they were called Spin Out back in the early days in Sunningdale. Zach was on drums. Sorry, Zach was a guitarist. A guy called Gary Roberts was a singer. Gary Nuttall, who's now he was my guitarist for years and has been Robbie Williams' guitarist for 25 years, and my brother on drums.
That's funny, because I saw Zach also play for Robbie.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And that would have been maybe just before. And the band Walk On, and in fact, their bass player, whose bass player was Pino Palladino.
Yeah, because that's after the Ox died.
Yes. Which is it's such a shame. But Pino's a Cardiff boy. So it's Cardiff Arena, all there. The band Walk On, Townsend walks on last. And it's dim lights, and he walks to the center, Townsend, guitar around him, and he just stands there staring. It was like a Michael Jackson thing, crowd going absolutely crazy. Daltrey just to the back, and he slowly puts his hand in his top pocket, and you see him pull out these shades, and it's so slow. He obviously planned this. He puts them on like that, and then he just bam, 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 bam. Oh my gosh. I absolutely, the whole place, 7,500 people lost their collective minds. And I was just gone, incredible. You know, yeah. Old enough to know better. But we were, all of us in that arena, bam, bam, bam. And I was like, that is how you start it. And of course, that song, just as a starter, for him to do that, obviously Zach is straight into that crazy amount of drums. Things. How many drums can you hit in one go, that song, isn't it? Bam, 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 bam. Yeah, exactly. And it was just, exactly.
Like
just the best thing.
The Muppets.
Exactly. I mean, it says something about that song and his status as well. He put shades on, but he could have put, you know, those glasses that have got the Groucho Marx moustache and all that, and done exactly the same thing and got pretty much exactly the same reaction.
It could have been plenty of other songs. He could have gone, bam,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Bam,
it could have been
bam, bam, bam.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And nobody hits a guitar like Pete Townsend. You can't do it. It's like he just has this, it's not the guitar, it's not the sound, it's not the amp. It's the way he hits it. And I just don't know any other guitarist that can do what he does.
But so quick, so wild, you know, the whole windmill thing, you just think, how is he not just making stupid noise?
Missing it.
Completely, you know, yeah.
Missing it, smashing it. But he gets, oh.
Yeah, I remember Roger telling me a story once when Pete was doing the windmills and he's doing, and he had the whammy bar on the guitar and it flipped round the other way.
Right.
And he went straight through his hand. Like literally in there, out the other side.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Yeah. I think that would have put you off windmilling, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Was that the end of his windmilling?
He probably just carried
days?
On. Probably yeah, just exactly. carried on, pulled it off and got blood all over his guitar. And
exactly.
You know, that was the beauty of the Who, wasn't it? You know,
exactly. I mean, the footage of him, you know, Keith getting stabbed in the leg with a gorilla sedative, which is mad,
it was
his drum tech.
An elephant tranquilizer.
Elephant tranquilizer.
A horse, not elephant, a horse tranquilizer. It's what it was.
Which knocks out a horse. But yet, you watch that footage and Keith is flagging and then all of a sudden he has that in and he is back on it.
We got to your onstage audition, you get the part. How did your life change at that point? Or was it a bit of a slow burn as you were filming and kind of...
Well, with that time, I was at that particular moment in my life, I was only 17 and I'd been playing piano in like wine bars and local pubs and, you know, wherever they'd have me, weddings, you know, parties, whatever.
You were already doing that by 17?
Yeah. Oh, at 15, I was doing that. I was the piano player in the corner doing Billy Joel and... you know, Stevie Wonder and Elton John. And yeah, that was that's how I learned my craft, really. Everything changed from there. And in as much as I was suddenly thrown into the lion's den, really, because I'd never acted before. And the only reason I went up for that part was because I knew there was a potential record deal at the end of it, the elusive record deal, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, when I got the part, it was like, okay, so I've actually got to do this now. I've got to star in a film with Roger Daltrey, you know. So, you know, that part of my life, I really was, you know, talking about kind of like nerves, like it was at that screen test. Like you try going, turning up first day filming of a major motion picture and not having ever acted before, you know.
Wow. And they didn't give you any training or anything per se? You just had
read
and that was it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of rehearsal stuff, but they wanted it to be a natural. And I was that character, you know. There was so much, I had so much in common with that character. You know, just played music my whole teenage years. I was a singer, I was a songwriter. My dad was kind of like quasi manager of me at that particular moment. And then, you know, in Buddy's song, Roger Daltrey played my dad and he was supposed to be kind of like managing me. And
And I suppose you were kind of playing a similar character to yourself in the fact that your music was different to your dad, Roger Daltrey, or your dad in real life. That kind of move away from and that disapproving. I mean, did your dad ever disapprove of what you were listening to if it wasn't kind of what?
There were some things, when the 80s came along and it was like, a little bit more synthesized, and I'd be getting into Nick Kershaw and Howard Jones, and Prince was my idol, through my teenage years. I think Dad appreciate he's a music man, so like he appreciates talent. But of course, it's just the kind of way it goes. It's like the same that I don't really understand a lot of the stuff that my kids listen to now, you somehow turn into your dad, don't you? It's like, oh, it's all bloody boom boom. You find yourself saying these things and start feeling like old.
No, I've been doing that for the last 3 years, I think, with my son, and also with Alex. Alex is far more hip than I am.
You've got to. I've got to. Otherwise,
No, I know you got th
got to stay
I'll
relevant, man.
age. I'll
Got to stay
age.
relevant. Yeah,
If I don't stay
exactly.
relevant, I'll age quickly. I
Yeah.
do just have to. We do. It would be remiss to not just say that Buddy was absolutely incredible, by the way. It'd be easy just to
Oh.
move on. I watched it over and over, and I used to watch it with my mum, and we went and then saw the stage show as well. And
Oh, you did?
oh, absolutely.
You would have seen my mate Bob playing Buddy. He's still a good friend.
Oh, really?
We had this funny thing where Roger organized a gathering of buddies because there was a buddy before me where
In the
they had a
TV.
TV show,
Yeah, that's
that
right.
was just called Buddy, and that was Wayne, and he played Buddy originally, and then I played him in the film, and then Bob Golding, who's fantastic, he's one of my bestie mates now,
Is he
is a,
really?
oh he's so funny, he's brilliant. He played him on stage, which where you would have seen it, I guess. And
Yes.
he had a so Roger invited us all round to the farm, the salmon farmhouse
Yeah.
in Sussex, and we all brought our kids and stuff. It was great, and we all got to meet the other buddies.
Lovely. Can I just get the timeline right then? So film comes out 1991. Does the film come out before the single, or does the single come out before the film? I can't remember. I saw the film in the cinema. I was 15 and just wanted to be you. But was the single out after the film was released or before?
Yeah, it wasn't far behind. What
Right.
happened was the first major kind of promotional round that I did was with Roger to promote the film. So we did, your Philip Schofield, what was the TV show that you
Going
did on
live.
Saturday morning? Yeah, so Going Live with him, and I did a few other bits and pieces with him, when and he'd like parade me around, it's like, "Here's my boy." And I'd very
It's
often do
so bizarre, isn't it? It's so
I know,
bizarre.
so weird. And I'd very often do a song from the soundtrack. So I would do like a piano song more than anything else. There's a song called Secrets of the Heart or Torn in Half. There's a couple of kind of power ballady stuff. So I would do those live on TV. That was my first experience of being on TV shows like that. So the film came out, and it was like Roger Daltrey in Buddy Song introducing Chesney Hawkes at the bottom, and which is the way it should be, absolutely.
Well,
And the film it did okay, it's it was it wasn't kind of like number one in the box office or anything, but it started to do okay. And then we released The One and Only, literally off the back of it, and of course that was like a game changer, and a very stratospheric kind of rise, and got to number one within, I think it was 6 weeks of release. And so suddenly my star was rising. And then of course they changed the packaging for the film to the one and only Chesney Hawkes in Buddy Song with Roger Daltrey at the bottom.
I'm sure he
So
was fine with that.
he was fine. It was,
So
So
your life must have gone through the roof then at that point when the single came out.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of changed everything, you know. So a sudden fame like that is like, no matter how much you experience it, like, because obviously all my dad's friends had fame and my dad had fame, and I kind of had seen it a little bit growing up. There's nothing can really prepare you for the onslaught of how crazy it really is when you have that kind of fame, you know, so young and so quickly. It was pretty nuts. I feel like, you know, I equate it to kind of being in the eye of a storm, you know, because you have your kind of circle of people and it's kind of okay in there, but then everything around is just like, you know, I never knew where I was waking up. Because it wasn't just in the UK, it was a big, it was a hit in America. It was number one all over the world, really. So I would be like, I go off to Japan, I'm going to Sweden, I'm going to New York, I'm going to Belgium, I'm coming back to England to do a gig in Leeds. And it was like, it was ridiculous for a good year.
I was looking at the top selling songs of that year, and the one and only was seventh in 1991. And some of the songs that were, you know,
it's huge, isn't it?
Were outsold by the one and only were, you know, massive. Like Get Off, Prince, Justified and Ancient. You know, you
what?
Get Ready for This, Two Unlimited.
Two outsold Prince.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just for that one little window, though.
Well, yeah. But the only songs that outsold the one and only were Any Dream Will Do, Jason Donovan, Do the Bartman, The Simpsons.
I love that Bart Simpson outsold.
I mean, which a friend of mine actually co-wrote.
Oh, that's hilarious. I'll
tell you about that one day.
I'm Too Sexy, Right Said Fred.
Yeah.
The Shoop Shoop Song.
Cher.
Bohemian Rhapsody, a small sleeper hit called Everything I Do It For You.
Oh, yeah.
So,
was that
I mean,
the same year?
Yeah, it was.
And Bohemian
Rhapsody
was only the last couple of weeks of that year, but it sold so much because of.
It's when he died.
It's because of
when Freddie died. Yeah.
That's you outsold Crazy by Seal.
Yeah, that's
what.
It's such a good song, though. It's One and Only is a cracking song. Nick Kershaw. Yeah. If you didn't know, you'd kind of I didn't know, and then I found out that it was written by Nick Kershaw, and went,
yeah,
of course it was.
Of course it is.
Just,
yeah,
you can just hear him in it, and just bold coming out with the title of the song in the opening second of the.
Yeah.
It's pretty ballsy, isn't it?
He's also singing on it. It's me and Nick singing on the BVs for that song.
Does he, on the single release?
You listen to the choruses, you can pick out Nick. And of course, he played that iconic solo as well. So
that was right. Okay. Got you.
Now, here's my thing. You were a young lad. You're playing piano. You can pick up a guitar. Was your intention before Buddy to be a live act Chesney Hawkes or as part of a band? As a teenager, what were you, you're going out, you're doing these jobs. What was the aim? Were you thinking, I want to make it with my band? Or were you going to sort of, you wanted it to be yourself, you know, singer-songwriter kind of thing?
No, actually, it was bands. I always had bands. First gig I ever did was my brother's a drummer, and it still is. Since we were babies, Jody was a drummer and I was the singer. So it was kind of like the Partridge Family. Even my sister was in the band from early days.
Right.
So my first gig was at a brownie hut because my Auntie Gloria was a brown owl. My first ever gig. Like, I was probably 11, 12, something like that.
Love that.
And so I always had bands. Then after those days, that early days, was kind of family bands. Then I met Gary Nuttall, who I spoke to you about earlier on, who's now Robbie's guitarist. Gary and I, I always wrote songs, like even as young as 12 years old. and played them live even then. But then Gary and I started writing together quite a lot, and we had a great partnership, Gary and I. One of those, like, he's also a great singer. So, like, we had that kind of, like, vocal blend thing that just doesn't come around very often. You know, we used to do, like, Everly Brothers stuff, and always felt like if I was going to make it, it was going to be with Jody and Gary. It's just the way it was, you know. But of course, that didn't work out like that. But Jody and Gary stayed with me through the whole time, you know, so we're always like a one for all for one situation. And then even after the one and only days, like, and I'm talking kind of mid-90s now, like 95, 96, whatever, we reformed as a band. And
okay, so that was the reason for that first question, because I was interested in knowing, you know, as a teenager, what your dreams and intentions were, because then that opportunity comes along, which no one around our age, we're all similar ages, no one would say the one and only, never heard that song. It was huge. Everyone in Britain of an age knows Chesney Hawkes and that song. And so you're faced with some, so it wasn't just a single that did all right. It hit the top 50 or so. No, it was huge. Was there a moment where you consciously had to make a decision on, oh, hang on, do I just follow this through for a while, or what do I do about the band, or hang on, do I use this now as a platform for the band, or what?
Well, yeah, it's
or was funny,
it
just not
it?
As
it's
easy
a...
as that?
No, I mean, once I was a signed artist and a proven successful solo artist, that's kind of where my head was at that point.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. Yeah.
Because it
totally
kind of changes.
Understand.
Yeah, it kind of changes everything. And actually, you know, I look back at that time there, and I feel like I definitely left Jody and Gary behind a little bit without kind of, I was young. Without really thinking about that, you know, the kind of implications
17.
Of what 17, 18, you know, so without kind of really kind of thinking about the implications of how this might affect them, because it was always us as a band. And I just, you know, I didn't have time to think about it really.
No, of course not.
It's not till afterwards when, you know, when I talked to Jody McBrough and he's like, oh yeah, I was just a member of the band paid by the record label. And, you know, it was, that kind of thing, you know. I don't regret any of that at all, and I just you just look back and think I probably could have handled that a bit better if I had the know-how that
if
I
you
have
weren't
now.
17
like,
years old,
if I wasn't a kid, if I wasn't a baby.
Yeah absolutely.
Exactly, because that just doesn't happen to everyone, does it? Just doesn't happen to everyone.
No it's a rare thing when stars align in that fashion, you know, where it's the right song, the right artists, with the right team, at the right time. That's the other thing. The zeitgeist had to allow it. You know?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
If it had happened 3 years later, competing with Oasis and Pulp and Blur and all that, it wouldn't have happened.
But
it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have worked. But it was close enough to the '80s. I, you know, listening to it again and trying to listen to it with fresh ears. There's a lot of Lamal in there as well. There's a bit of Kajagoogoo in what he's writing there in terms of the melody, and I don't know, it feels like a crossover between the '80s and into the '90s. Is what I'm trying to say, and I think that is what is really great about the single, that it does bridge that decade, you know, those two decades.
I would say it bridges that 80s that you're on about, and I'm going to say it, Britpop, not Oasis and Blur, but what we would refer to as other Britpop, and I think that's why it holds up so well. If it genuinely wasn't good, great. People wouldn't listen to it, and you still wouldn't be playing it to thousands of people at festivals, which I know you are. You know, I've seen you do it. If it's rubbish, that's not going to happen. And so it is quite a phenomenon. It's just amazing that it still happens.
These songs like this come along now and again, don't they? I call them songs with wings.
Yeah. I have to say, you were talking about vocals that combine well. And I think yours and Nick's combined, listening to you singing, I can't remember the name of the track on Sunset Sessions.
Oh, Lost in You.
Lost in You. The harmonies in that are absolutely lovely.
Amazing.
And, you know, your voices really complement each other.
Yeah, I agree. I think Nick and I should do some more stuff together.
Definitely. I was just going to say, let's have a new album, please.
Yeah. Well, actually, I do have a new album coming out this year, and Nick does have 3 songs on it. So there you go.
Yes.
Kershaw collabs.
Now we're talking.
We'll talk to you about tours and dates and all that kind of stuff, because we know you're based in LA. I'm not seeing any Manchester dates. We're both, well, Salford and Manchester. So I'm not seeing any. I mean, maybe
it's not purposeful at all. I did quite a lot of North stuff last year, so in fact, the last time I was in Liverpool, I played the arena as part of a kind of a packaged thing. But no, I you're right, there's definitely a few northern dates that need to be added.
There's no judgment here, Chesney. No judgment here.
I would like to know, I want to get a bit more geeky. There's a few questions that we definitely like to ask because this is about live gigs. Because you've had such a unique upbringing, what do you class as your first gig? And by that, what was the first live gig that you went to that either you paid for or you said, I want to go and see?
Right.
This gig, because you will have seen live music, you were part of live music, but what was your gig? What was your first gig?
Well, I mean, obviously the first gig I ever went to see would have been the Tremolos.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't quite fit into your parameters there. Obviously I didn't pay for it and it wasn't something that I'm like, oh, I need to go and see this band, but talk about leaving an impression. I was very, very young. I would have probably have been 6, something like that. Yeah. And Dad used to take us now and again, and we'd hang backstage and be kind of like peeking through the wings at this magical scene, you know, me and my brother and sister just kind of like, wow, you know, and Dad's out there with his leather trousers and his shirts undone to his navel and hair everywhere, like 70s hair all out here and lights and knickers being thrown on stage. And, you know, I mean, it was just like, it's overwhelming for a young kid to witness that, and especially as it's my dad. You know, and then afterwards, after the gig, you know, you're in the dressing room and then, you know, all the boys come in all sweaty and everything, and they let in a couple of girl fans or something, and someone will come in and ask for their autographs and all that, you know. Those moments will stick with me forever.
Of course, and you're really remarkably well adjusted for somebody who at the age of 6 witnessed your dad having women's underwear thrown at him. You're remarkably
that well was adjusted. Just normal for me, Chris.
Yeah, well, you know, that just it says a lot about you, and it says a lot about your upbringing that you were able to take that in your stride.
Well, you know, my upbringing really was quite liberal. You know, my mum was also an actress and game show hostess. She was one of the golden girls on The Golden Shot. But we're all a bit too young to remember The Golden Shot, but some of your older listeners would definitely know The Golden Shot.
Was it Huey Green?
It was Bob Monkhouse.
Bob Monkhouse. Right.
Do you know, I think the gig that keeps coming to my mind, and I don't know why it keeps coming out, because I was probably very...
Oops. Due to a brief Zoom glitch, we can't hear what Chesney's first gig was. His first one was Gary Moore, around 1985. The rest of this section should make sense now. Onwards!
I was probably like 12 or something like that. And that's the gig that I remember.
So this was just post Thin Lizzy, was it?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And
I'm like, Gary, I'm like, yeah, what year? So you think you'd have been 12 years old?
Yeah, because he released an amazing blues album, 1989 or something like that? I Still Got the Blues, I think it was called. Or
yeah,
something.
That's the one.
Still
Got the Blues.
Was it called
that's
that?
The song I was just singing, yeah.
All right.
Got the Blues.
Yeah, and there were some absolute bangers on that.
That was 1990.
1990, right, okay.
Oh, gosh.
But you think it was maybe right about 83?
I think it was 83. Before that I went to see him.
Oh, but he had Wild Frontier in 87 and Run for Cover in 85.
Run for Cover, that rings a bell. That right, rings a bell. Yeah.
That was
yeah.
That was 1985.
I've seen him, I saw him a few times over the years, and I definitely did see that the Still Got the Blues tour as well. But that 1985, I think that sounds about right. Run for Cover at Hammersmith Odeon.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll always call it Hammersmith Odeon, no matter what anyone says.
Absolutely.
It ain't no Labatt Apollo.
No, no. Hammersmith Odeon. And I think people of a certain ilk and age know exactly when you say Hammersmith. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah. Not the Labatt's O2 Carabao.
Whatever the bloody
cuff, whatever
it
is. It's rubbish.
Yeah.
So we often have a round called the quickfire round, and it's never quickfire.
Yeah.
But
no.
we do like to ask these questions, and we vary them sometimes, and they're really straightforward. In your position as an artist, you can answer the question as a performer or as a punter. So what you class as the most, what's the most outstanding gig you've been? It's hard to finish that sentence because I don't know if you're going to answer as a performer. It could be that you walked off stage and just gone, oh my gosh, that was unbelievable, or whether you were a punter at a gig.
I'm going to go with Prince, Love Sexy Tour.
Oh, the Love Sexy Tour.
So that was 1888,
89? 88, I think. And that would have been at Wembley Arena. And
wow,
just blew my socks off. I mean, I was such a massive Prince fan anyway. And I don't know. I mean, I guess I was a bit too young to be going to see him in 84, 85 when, through Purple Rain years and stuff. But and I didn't go to see him until Love Sexy, which, I think it was 88. God, it was incredible. He came on stage in a Cadillac. Just
brilliant.
I saw him probably, 11, 12 times over the years. And, he's still, to me, like, there's no one that ever touched that talent, in such a small body. He had it. He had it all compact into this small little package, and he had everything. I mean, just the most incredible musician, and the songs and the production and his image, in a way he held himself, that kind of mystique that he had that not a lot of artists have these days, and not a lot of them had what he had even back then, Funny enough, I was watching documentary last night about the making of We Are the World.
Oh yeah, that's on my list to watch.
You've got to watch it, guys.
Is
honestly,
it is it amazing?
Oh, it's phenomenal.
Loads of close-ups of Bob Dylan.
Yeah, it's called The Greatest Night in Pop. There's so many great moments on it. The Bob Dylan moment was so great because when it came to do his part, he didn't know what to do and he couldn't sing it. And Quincy Jones was just trying to coax him through it, and he was trying to sing it like everyone else was trying to sing it, but he's not that kind of singer.
Yeah, the world.
Yeah, exactly. But he was trying to sing it like normal, but he just wasn't getting it at all. And in the end, Stevie Wonder was sitting at the piano, and Quincy Jones, everyone out of the room was just him and Stevie and Bob. And Stevie was doing like a mimic of what he thought how Bob would do it.
No way. Know?
Yeah, yeah. So instead of being like, we are the world, he's going, we are the world. And like, it was, honestly, it is so great. There's so many incredible moments. But the reason I brought it up just then is that like they showed some clips of, because that the day that happened, it was the American Music Awards. And they were hoping to get Prince to be a part of it, which he didn't in the end. But they showed like clips of him in the crowd. And he won some awards and everything, but he just had this like steely look on his face, and everyone's going crazy around, and he's just like, completely like steely, total mystique. You don't know what's going on in his mind.
Yeah.
And I just love that about Prince. And yeah, he was just the greatest, you know. And so I will always say the best live performer that I've ever seen.
Well, no one's mentioned more than Prince on this podcast series.
In fact, it's
every second. And
the two names that are mentioned that have been mentioned most on this whole series.
Oh, yeah.
From the very first podcast is Bob Dylan and Prince.
Oh, how funny. I just did it in one go.
One of them being the best gig ever and the other one being the worst gig ever. So it's exactly. Generally either do you get good Dylan or bad Dylan when you went to see him?
So that's got to be the next question for you. What is the worst gig?
Well, I went to see Van Morrison once. And
we've had him before.
He had his back to the crowd.
Yes.
He was like you could tell in his mind, he was like, they're looking at me. Why are they looking at me? he was still brilliant. I could be wrong, but like, I guess the most unusual moment I've seen an artist on stage.
Oh, I'm thinking of this story, and I can't remember who it was who told us the story, but it was on this podcast, and it was about him doing a beach festival, and he had come off stage. And he needed to get from one part of, he had to walk across hot sand to get to his truck or his a waiting hovercraft or something. But basically, if I'm remembering it right, he had two lackeys there, each with planks of wood, putting them down one by one so he could put his feet down and not get burnt or not damage his shoes. I think I know who it was who said it, but I don't think it was on the recording. I think it was after we'd stopped recording. So I'm not going to...
It's so fascinating to me that two... And it is genuinely, I mean, how many episodes are we in? A billion episodes. And Van Morrison and Bob Dylan come up as being potentially the best gig someone's ever seen, and yet also the worst gig someone's ever seen. And I'm a Dylan fan.
Yeah,
but when I worked at Cardiff, I can't remember if it was before we were chatting. Oh no, The Who. So when I worked at Cardiff Arena, I saw loads of bands working with them, and more often than not, Bob Dylan, we would have people asking for money back because it was just the wrong era. It was the early 2000s, and he'd come and he'd sneak on. The one time he stayed upstage. Right, behind musicians, and he sat side on, and he changed all the melodies, all the tunes.
Yeah.
Age? What? You know?
Because he's not a pop star. He's not. He's not a performer. Nope. Really, he's really not. He's mesmerizing because he's Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And even from the early days, like when it was just him with a harmonica and a guitar, he is a mesmerizing. You can't take your eyes off of him.
Yeah.
But he's not a natural performer. It's like he was so fish out of water, in that room with that documentary last night, where you've got Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder and Cyndi Lauper and Huey Lewis and Kenny Rogers, Michael Jackson, all these like actual real proper performers, and they're all singing like amazing parts, and you could see Bob Dylan's face. He's just had this frown on his face the whole time. Yeah, horror of being like, what am I going to do here?
Yeah,
I don't know what to do. Waylon Jennings walked out.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he just got up and walked out. I'm not doing this. They started singing in Swahili because I think it was Stevie Wonder wanted to He wanted to do a part to represent Africa, and so he started singing, hey, how about we do this, man? And he's like singing this part in Swahili. And that was enough for Waylon Jennings. Waylon was like, I'm fucking out of here, man. No, he was no. What did he say? Brilliant. No outlaw has ever spoken in Swahili. He was gone.
He was the guy who sang that. Was he Dukes of Hazzard? Did he sing Dukes of Hazzard theme tune?
Probably was. Yes. Just a good old boy. Yeah.
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 That's right, him. Okay. That's Waylon Jennings. Yeah.
Right.
Gosh. I love that.
I can imagine him.
You just plucked that one there, Chesney. That's not gonna miss. I'm gonna be shouting for that one at your next live gig.
Well, listen, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee.
What?
So I know all those artists. I grew up with Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson, Willie Nelson. I have a little bit of a country heart.
Wow.
Yeah.
My dad made songs like Witch to Line Man and all. I just think I missed out on that genre because I don't know enough. I should get recommendations from you. Anyway.
Yeah. As performer, what was worst gig?
Oh god.
Wow.
If that's not too triggering.
Back in kind of late 90s, I kind of went wrong way round. Obviously, I had huge success in the early 90s. And then I kind of like, after all that, dropped with the record label and everything, I was like, right, I've got to dust myself off, start again here. And yeah. I formed bands. I just wanted to be in Radiohead, basically, and turn up to 11 and shoegaze.
We all did. We all wanted to be in Radiohead.
Of course we did. Yeah, we're men of a certain age. And it was quite humbling because we did all the London gigs. I played, like, people didn't even know it was me. I played Camden Underworld, all those little gigs, and some real shitty gigs where you pay to play, you know, yeah. Literally. We were called, at that point, we were called EBB, E-B-B. And we started, you know, we actually did get a little following in the end. The gigs were great and everything. But then we went to New York for a while and had some terrible gigs. Like, I remember doing one gig where, because we really only went to try and kind of get a record deal. You know, it's like we're trying to build some kind of following. So you go over there for like this. A lot of bands did this back then, like, and did it in New York and LA, where you go over for a couple of months. And there was one gig, and I remember we supported a band called Czar, and they had a bit of a buzz around them. And I had record company people were coming, and I think they were mainly coming to see Czar. Well, they definitely were, because Czar were on before us. And so Czar did, and it was the best gig ever. I watched them from the back, you know, and they were really good, and they had an amazing crowd, and there was loads of record people there, record business people there. It was buzzing. I was like, this is going to be awesome, you know, we're going to go on straight after them. But literally, they went off stage and the club emptied. And it was like, oh, just like, no. Two or three punters still there at the back with a beer, and then like one record label person stayed, or you know, and it was just like the most soul destroying moments, you know. I mean, there's loads of those kind of things. I mean,
how do you get through that in that moment when that actually happens?
You just got to go for it, you know. It's like, I think we drunk through it, you know what I mean? We all had shots before we went on, like, just let's just fucking do this, let's go and have fun, let's just do what we do. You know, and
treat it like a rehearsal.
Make it a rehearsal. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly that. Yeah. I mean, but there's other gigs. I mean, I remember playing in Manchester, actually. I think it was at the Academy in Manchester. Remember that gig?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Still going. I still go there. Yeah.
Yeah. And this would have been, I mean, I guess it would have been early 2000s or something like that. And yeah, the crowd was
three venues.
Yeah. That's right. Academy
1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be able to tell you which one it was, but like the crowd slightly turned on me. It actually might have been late 90s, so it was like, you know, a bit of a Britpop crowd. And of course, if a pop star like me comes in, they're just going to turn their nose up, aren't they? You know, so it was just bad booking, basically. And I think I went on after Pulp or something, or one of those bands. Like, and of course, it just wasn't the right fit, you know, and I ended up cans being thrown on stage. I got hit in the face with a bottle at one point, you know. And of course, when you get into moments like that, you either cry and run off stage like a girl, or you go, fuck you lot, you're all a bunch of cats. You know what I mean? Yeah,
exactly.
And I got a bit like that, you know. I was like, I don't give a fuck what you think, you know.
Good on you.
You know, was it? I thought, well, you know, if you can't beat them, join them, right?
That's exactly.
That's the rock and roll.
Exactly.
That's proper punk rock. I love that. Yeah. So do as a father, because you mentioned your children, I think you're a father of three, is that right?
Yes. Yep.
Snap, me too. And
well done.
I'm pleased to say that all three of my kids love their music, and we're very lucky because I do a show in the kids' field in Glastonbury. So my kids have literally grown up going to Glastonbury every year.
Wonderful.
And so before they were even teenagers, the artist that they've seen live is just mad. And we go to gigs regularly. I love it.
You should interview them on here.
Well, it's hilarious. I think they've been to more gigs than some of our guests, actually. It's kind of funny.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, I saw Metallica headline Glastonbury, Elton John, you know.
It's mad.
And Adele before she was big. Do you get to go to gigs? Is that a thing that you do with your children?
Well, I do, but it's a rarity because we're very, very rarely together in the same place at the moment. My son, Casey, he's 22. He's here in LA, but I'm very often touring. My daughter is in St. Andrews University.
Oh, in Scotland?
Yes, yeah.
My dad went fabulous. There.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
What's she studying? Or is that too...
No, she's studying animal behavior.
Amazing.
So nice. She'll probably end up, I don't know, tagging chimps in the wild or something like that.
Brilliant.
Excellent.
And then my youngest son, Indy, is my lead guitar player. He's absolutely incredible. He's at the Brit School in London.
Excellent. Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we go to more stuff together. We're planning to go to... There's a musical that's just opening called For One Night Only, I think it's called, and it's about Live Aid, right? So my friend went to see it the other day and he said it was absolutely amazing and we have to see it, so I'm planning to go and see that with Indy. We'll do stuff together, but as I say, it's difficult. I wanted to go because my daughter's a big Adele fan, and I got her tickets to go and see her
in Vegas,
yeah, and I would have loved to have been there, but I was somewhere on, you know, somewhere in the world.
Oh, yeah. Did she go though? Did she still?
She
go?
Did. It was quite a crazy story actually, because I managed to get tickets on the wrong day, and of course it's a big deal. You know, they all her and her brother and their two friends drove to Vegas, got there, went to pick up the tickets, wrong day. It was the day before. Yeah,
no.
So it was absolute. And there's one of the perks of, you know, knowing a few people, you know. And so I called a friend who manages Adele, you know, and I was like, mate, please help me out here. And it was an absolute, like, I managed to get him when it was like, he was somewhere in the middle of it all. He happened to be there. And my daughter's crying, you know, because Adele's her absolute hero. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry, Jeff. Let me just give me a second, you know. And the show was like just like about to start and everything, and then eventually Jonathan sorted out tickets. He's like, I can't get the same kind of tickets, but because you know I got the nosebleed tickets and they were still like $200 each, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But Jonathan got her in like the third row, like, and I got this amazing video from Jesse holding the camera like, Danny, Adele looked right at me, you know. And it's just right, like literally just like blubbering tears, you know, just the best.
Good dadding right there.
It was a good dadding.
Expert,
yeah.
Dadding.
It worked out well.
I've said it on this podcast before. The one thing I continually love in life, and I hope it sort of doesn't stop, but I fear as they get older, is seeing my children enjoy it. And the amount of times I've been stood in a, you know, a muddy field in Somerset, and I've looked at Grace, who's on my wife's shoulders, belting out every word to Florence and the Machine or Adele. Maybe. And then, you know, my boy on my shoulders along to Kendrick Lamar 2 years ago. It's just amazing, yeah. That feeling, knowing that my kids are loving live music, you know,
yeah.
as much as me. But you get to play on stage with your son.
Oh no, that is an incredible feeling. And he is so good.
That?
He is so good. So I'm proud of him. And I wouldn't have him on stage if he wasn't, you know. I mean, I know there's a little bit of you know, bias there, you know, but he is so good.
No, there's
and
a lot
I
at
love
stake.
It.
You know, you're not gonna get somebody on stage who can't cut it. So...
I can't do that, you know. So just to have him, there's been we've started doing Purple Rain, funnily enough, in the set when we do kind of more the kind of like the Butlins crowd and all that kind of thing, you know. And he does the solo for Purple Rain, and so all of us,
which is mega,
it's incredible. Like, you know,
yeah,
he just kills it every time. So what I've started doing, because when he first started doing, he was only like 15 when he first came on stage with me.
No way.
And he was just kind of a bit kind of, you know, nervous and stayed back with me and kind of looked the other way. So now all the rest of us just step back to the drums, and he goes right out the front. So all I see is this silhouette of my son with the lights and his foot on the monitor and get down on his knees and the crowd just going crazy, you know. I mean, it's just
brilliant.
Honestly, the most rewarding, yes. Beautiful thing.
It's making me think, Oscar Boone. So our first guest on the podcast, first guest ever was Clint Boone from Inspiral Carpets. And so their most recent tour that they went out on, their new bassist was Clint's son, Oscar.
Amazing.
And it's exactly the same thing. They're not going to bring out a bassist who can't cut it.
No.
And at the start, I think he was quite kind of nervous. But
yeah.
Then towards the end of the tour, I saw, and they've just been touring Australia and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, amazing.
But yeah. There was one lovely video clip that they posted, and it's Oscar just there, you know, rocking it in the bass. Somebody kicks on a beach ball, and Oscar, who doesn't play football, just doesn't even break sweat, just boots it straight back into the crowd and doesn't miss a note.
Now he's on playing.
And I thought, yeah, he's on it. He's got this. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's the same with my son. He's exactly the same.
Will he be? So, is he part of your band all the time, or is
yeah?
It just,
I mean, as long as he deems me worthy, and he's able to do these gigs, he's on the payroll. You know,
yeah.
He's definitely part of the gang, and the boys love him. And you know, it's like, for me, if that's what he wants to do for a living, it's the best internship ever. You know, and
that's right. I was going to say, is he enjoying it in the Brit School? I have a couple of friends that sort of came through Brit School and had a great time.
Yeah, he's coming towards the end of his tenure there now. He finishes in May. So, yeah, I think he's going to miss it. It's a great school. Yeah.
And if you sort of had to say to him, look, if you want to go and do your thing, that's okay with me.
Oh, of course. You know, I realise, you know, your old man's not that, you know, it's not the be all and end all, you know. He's got his own bands, he does his own things, and of course he's not going to play with me forever, but you know, while he's doing it, he's up on stage with his uncle playing drums, with his dad, you know, singing. And it's just he's loving it, and I think it really helped with just all the other things that he's doing, because he's relaxed now, because you know, he's played in front of 25,000 people with me, and you know, and that kind of thing. So
yeah,
it's you know, it's quite a remarkable thing to have done when you're at that age, you know, like he was. Well,
does
18
he
now,
but... does he fancy the session route, or do you have a band that he's?
Yeah, he's a writer, a producer. He's very natural, you know, in the studio. So I think he could do both. And I think the studio might be more his path. I don't know, but I think he'll always play live.
Because I'm wondering, you know, apart from yourself, is this, you know, do we look out for a specific band? But at the moment, you think he might go down the studio route?
Early days. It's early days. You know, who knows? And I just marvel at what he's going to end up doing. I marvel at what he's doing now. So it's just wonderful.
I love that.
And you've got a gig coming up at Kentish Forum, 30th of May. Is that right?
31st of May. 02 Forum. Kentish Town. Yeah, it's my first headline gig in London since the 90s, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, I've never stopped playing live. You know, and I've gigged all the way through, but it's rare that I'll do like a, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, I've done like the odd kind of Half Moon, Putney, those kind of gigs. But the O2 Forum, it's a proper gig, you know. I'm not saying the Half Moon isn't, as I love that venue.
Yeah.
But it's 2,500 people at the O2, you know. So
yeah.
It's a bit more of a, you know,
it's a big deal.
Big deal, exactly. Yeah. So I'm excited. I'm excited about that one.
Absolutely appreciate your time, but we don't let anyone go until we ask the last question, which is always a live recommendation. And it's like we repeat ourselves all the time, but because you've mentioned Prince,
yeah,
we always ask someone to recommend, it could either be a live album, So I love Under a Blood Red Sky, U2's album. Or it could be like a live clip, video clip that people just love watching. And the one that keeps coming up is the Prince one at the guitar gently weeps. Yes. Yeah,
where he throws it in the air and it doesn't come back down again.
But the thing is, for ages and ages and ages, I never saw the other camera angle to that. So he comes on, absolutely tears it apart, throws the guitar, walks off. And it wasn't for years, probably. It might have even been just last year that I saw the video from the other camera angle where you actually see his, your someone's mind on the side of the stage. You're just a huge guy who just catches the guitar in the air, but walks backwards.
I always wondered what happened. Oh, that's
just walks away. And I was like, that's where the guitar went.
That's great.
That guy is almost cooler than Prince, and that way catching it and then walking backwards.
Prince is 2 foot tall in his heels, so he just throws it up to this guy.
He just grabbed.
I'll have that, son. I'll have that.
So what would be your recommendation to our?
The thing that comes to mind for me is it's a YouTube clip of Lindsey Buckingham playing Big Love. I think it's in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And it's just him and an acoustic guitar. And I'm a huge Lindsey Buckingham fan. I don't know if you guys are, but
yeah, he's amazing.
Phenomenal player. And so go check it out. Big Love. I can't remember the venue, but it's live in Beverly Hills. So Lindsey Buckingham acoustic. I think it's at the Saban Theater in Beverly Hills.
Okay.
S-A-B-A-N. And it's just him with an acoustic guitar that I think even might be a nylon. And
he
plays Big Love, and it sounds like three guitarists. He's so all in with this performance, vocally, just so powerful and so passionate. And the way he plays the guitar is just phenomenal. Yeah, so go check that one out. Really,
I love that.
Yeah, so good. One of the best performances I've ever seen. It's just a moment. You know, of genius at work.
Brilliant. That's incredible.
Chesney, thank you so much for joining us tonight for this episode. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, thanks for having me.
And there we are, Chesney Hawkes, the nicest person I've ever met.
Well, bearing in mind, we did interview Nick Hayward. They're kind of on a level. Or was it Nick Kershaw? Can't remember. Anyway.
Can't say that. You have to cut that out. So what a wonderful guy. And I've forgotten about his background, because of course his dad being in the Tremolos and such a musical family, you know, getting to play with his brother, his sister. It's, I think a lot of people might assume they know who he is, what he is, or just think Chesney Hawkes and that single. And the way he spoke about handling that and how he handled it, what a great guy, because those things don't happen often. He was wanting to be part of a film and somehow came out with one of the biggest selling singles of that year. And, you know, it gets stuck under that one hit wonder title, which is wrong, because he is such a talented musician. But how he's navigated that through life, I don't think you could meet a happier man on the surface anyway. You know, he was lovely to chat to. We had good football chat. He's got a beautiful family. He still performs, travels.
Yeah, and you will have seen him recently on Michael McIntyre's big show. So if you didn't catch it on Saturday, then get on iPlayer and check out Chesney giving it the big beans.
Now, I liked it. You just said you will have seen him. I mean, that was very manipulative. That was very, you were assuming that all our listeners watch Michael McIntyre on Saturday night.
No, but I'm just assuming they watch anything with Chesney in it.
Are you ready for this, Chris?
Go on.
Every Saturday evening, me and half my family, we sit, we watch Gladiators and the Michael McIntyre Show. I'm telling you now, it is the best Saturday night TV for years and years. So you were right to assume it. I have. Okay. When this goes out, I will have seen it. I love it.
I still haven't watched the new series of Gladiators.
Oh, don't be so stupid. Come on.
I know I should
do. Gladiators.
I know. Just remind me of when I was 18, just about to go out to the pub. You'd watch, you'd have Noel's House Party, Baywatch, Gladiators, and then pub. That was it. It was Final Score, then Noel's House Party, Gladiators, watching and out. Oh God! Speaking of Gladiators,
oh my gosh, where the hell is this going? Go on.
Super Bowl. Did you watch it? Did you stay up?
Just give me a second, because I'm just thinking about that segue. Speaking of gladiators.
Gladiator, yeah, because they're in all the kit and the
gladiatorial, the battle. Now, because I actually don't know if we've had this conversation, but I've been a huge NFL fan since the 80s. So, yes, I normally try to stay up and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And just because of things that were going on, I'd just driven back from Cardiff and we left late. I got in and I can't go straight to bed no matter what time it is. After a long drive, I have to sit down. So I actually watched the first quarter and then realized I'm going to be shattered. And I avoided my phone and all contact until Monday morning, took the dog out for a walk, got back, watched the Super Bowl. What a game. Absolutely what a game. For a fan of the sport, I thought it was brilliant. We could go into why it was a defensive game. And why
we're not going to do that, are we?
No.
We're really not going to do that.
You've got to love the halftime show.
Yeah. Yeah. I do. I like the concept of it.
Yeah.
I do like the concept of it.
I love it because it's mad.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous and it's stupid as well.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous. And so it was Usher this year. I'm not a massive fan. It's not my bag. I really have to say.
It's like when you go and meet your friend's newborn baby who's really, really ugly and you go, oh, what a beautiful blanket.
Yeah.
That's what you've done. Let's just put it out there. We're okay with it. You and I like all kinds of music, and it's okay to not like certain kinds of music. Mm. Usher, I don't get it. I don't like the music, and I thought it was one of the worst halftime shows I've seen for years.
4 out of 5 stars in The Guardian.
Oh, absolute nonsense.
A daring show it was.
Daring? Why? Because he put on roller skates.
And took his shirt off.
Kept rubbing his hands around Alicia Keys' backside. Oh, yeah. Get off.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking forward to it. And when I watched the game, I actually forwarded through the halftime show because I was not interested in seeing him. And then watched it later that evening with the kids. But me and the kids then sat down that night. And for like an hour and a half, we just put on all the halftime shows over the years.
Yes.
Aww.
Which is what I've just done as well.
Some belters.
Absolute bangers. So been going since 1967, these halftime shows. But before, it used to be like military bands and all that kind of stuff. And then it was like jazz bands. So Ella Fitzgerald did it 1 year. Woody Herman's big band did it.
Ella Fitzgerald did it?
Yeah, she did it. Let me see when that was. But and then it wasn't until 1993 that it was just dying, basically. And also the Super Bowl was coming out of that early, mid to late 80s boom where it went global, you know, with the Fridge, William Perry and Chicago Bears and all that kind of stuff. So they got Michael Jackson in to do it.
Pepsi.
It must have been.
The Pepsi halftime show.
Yeah, that's it.
Michael Jackson one. Yeah, that was a good one.
But then it's been kind of hit and miss ever since. I mean, there was a Disney one. There was Blues Brothers did it one year. So Dan Aykroyd and John Goodman and Jim Belushi.
John Goodman?
With ZZ Top and James Brown.
John Goodman?
Yeah, because he did the sequel. He was in the sequel to Blues Brothers.
And they
had John Belushi.
No.
Obviously died by then, yeah. The year 2000. Oh my god, it was a Disney one. It was called The Tapestry of Nations. This was in Atlanta, Georgia. Phil Collins, Christina Aguilera, Enrique Iglesias, and Tony Braxton with an orchestra doing Disney hits.
Woo! I was in my last year of uni and didn't see that halftime show.
Followed by the next year, Aerosmith with NSYNC.
Okay, yeah, now I remember that one.
And they went by the name of AeroSync.
Have you made that up?
No.
You're kidding me. AeroSync.
No, AeroSync.
not N. Smith.
Nope, AeroSync.
Using their register. No, yeah. That's...
Oh, there's been some shockers. Shania Twain with No Doubt and Sting.
What?
Yeah. That was the one just before Janet Jackson with Justin Trousersnake.
Oh, of course. Where Lemon ripped off a
frontage
Velcro thing and
showed off her nunus.
Showed it. Her bosom. Her bosom. We're grown men. Her tit. Yeah. but the Prince one, mega. Bruce Springsteen.
Can't top it, yeah.
I enjoyed The Who one.
Do you know which one I watched some this morning and one which I hadn't seen before, and I just thought, because you don't get long, it's not like a half hour set or anything, you've got like 11 to 15 minutes and you've got to pack in as much as you can. And the one that I watched was Coldplay with Beyonce and Bruno Mars. Oh my god, just I mean, random. you may not be a fan of any of their music, or you might be big fans of all of us, but just to fit in 12 minutes, everything that they managed to do there, they managed to do tributes to past performers who had died. So there was Clarence, Bruce Springsteen's saxophonist, Prince, Whitney Houston. You know, they were kind of fitting that into the second half of Fix You. They had Uptown Funk.
They played over 1,056 songs.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was banging. It was really moving as well. I
that was
it really
the
moving.
Visual, because they had things going on in the crowd. It was
choirs and it was really gorgeous.
It was very Coldplay.
It was.
And they are quite a sight live. They're incredible like that. The Prince one is one that I'll always remember. That was amazing. And the one just a few years ago my George keeps playing it all the time with Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Eminem, Kendrick Lamar, 50 Cent, Marie Jablija.
Marie Jablija.
That was incredible. Who would you like to see do? Oh my gosh, I haven't even finished the question, but I know my answer. Genuinely, I've not thought about it till now. Who would you like to see do your halftime Super Bowl?
Halftime Super Chesney.
Chesney Hawks. There's actually only one answer to this.
Well, no. Can I just further my answer ever so slightly? Because it's never just one person, really. I mean, there'll be guests and stuff. So basically, I would want all of the musicians who have ever appeared on this podcast all on stage.
You imagine that.
Doing a version of We Are the World. That would be amazing. Imagine Matt Fraser, Rick Witter and Eddie Reader doing We Are the World.
Catherine Williams, Gaz from the Happy Mondays. Clint Boone.
No, that would be banging.
Yeah, right, we are the world. Yeah. I've just... So, Chesney watched the Netflix documentary, and I watched it on his recommendation.
I still not caught up with it yet. No, I totally
understand why he said you must watch it, because it's fascinating in so many ways. It's a really poor documentary, I think. I mean, it's over an hour and a half, and it's like, oh, God, come on, get on with it. But it's hilarious. And I actually forgot what a terrible song it is.
Oh, it's appalling. Oh, well, I mean, so is Feed the World, you know.
Get off. Hang up. Leave this place. Come on. That is a banger.
They won't be having snow.
Well, tonight, thank God it's them instead of you. I mean, that's one of the most confusing lines. No. Musically, I love that song. The lyrics, mad.
Yeah.
But it shows Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson literally just reeling off that song. But it was so funny seeing all the different characters. And he's right. The footage. And now I'm going to tie it in now to my answer on the Super Bowl. Bob Dylan.
Oh, Bob Dylan at the Super Bowl halftime.
Can you imagine Bob Dylan? Right? They'd have huge staging.
Right? Yeah.
Loads of really fancy. And everybody's waiting for him. And you can see his band. And he's actually doing it from the changing room backstage, an empty changing room, but he's hidden inside a locker. And of course he's singing brand new melodies and tunes to old songs, and that would be funny as
and special guest Mr. Van Morrison.
He comes on and just moans at people and is sort of mildly racist.
Tells
and...
people to get off their phones.
Yes. I mean, stop waving those lights at me.
Have some respect. Yeah. I think I prefer my suggestion. Incredible.
But then in that documentary, the footage of Bob Dylan not singing is brilliant, because he's doing a... remember John Redwood when he was randomly
doing the Welsh National Anthem?
Doing the Welsh National Anthem. Yeah. It's like that. And you're just thinking, oh, poor Bob.
He's just wandered in. He was in the studio next door. Doesn't know why he's here.
Well, what I actually didn't know is that it was straight off the back of the American Music Awards. So it's like the Brit Awards.
Mm.
Lionel Richie had hosted it, and they'd gotten all the stars to go straight from there to record it late evening, which is mad.
Yeah, but that's, I suppose that's the only way that they could do it, though.
Yeah, but also, no, the whole trying to make that happen was mental.
Right, well, mental. I really want to watch this, because I loved the documentary about the making of Live Aid as well. Oh, sorry, the recording of the single, Do They Know It's Christmas. I loved that.
I've not seen that one. I need to see that one as well. And just
I need to find it.
Status quo, getting everyone coked up.
I'll see if I can find those videos and pop them on the page for this episode. But
Well, the We Are the World one, that's on Netflix as we speak.
Great.
Obviously, if you're listening to this in 20 years, what are you doing?
Yeah.
and is Netflix still a thing? If you could let us know, please track Chris and I down. Just let us know.
The Gig Stories time capsule.
Yeah. Exactly. So I also just before we go, I'm sort of quite interested just on the topic of live gigs, as this is the podcast. I'd love to hear from some of our listeners about ones they've been to. So at the start of in the intro, I mentioned my walk this morning. I've been very excited for today because Idols' new album, Tank, T-A-N-G-K, is out. So I listened to it twice on the dog walk this morning. What an album, what a band. And the fact that they did it with Nigel Godrich, they you know, twisted his arm, who is known for so many things, but to listeners, and you and I, is Mr. Radiohead, to get him and also have Kenny Beats, wonderful hip-hop artist, who has produced, I think, including the first one or maybe from the second album on, also produces this stuff. It is an incredible album, absolutely brilliant. And I'm being sort of wound up by my bestie Maisie back in Cardiff, because he's going to see them tomorrow at their Bristol album launch gig. Now, this isn't get an acoustic guitar, play two songs and sign some albums. I believe they're playing an hour-long set. And I was thinking, this seems to be happening more and more. So I personally went and saw Shed 7 in HMV in Manchester just last month when they got their number one album. And they did easy half hour, if not more, and played a load of new songs and some oldies. And I was thinking, this seems to be a new thing, or at least a resurgence of something that used to happen. Has anyone else been? Is anyone else doing it? I seem to see a real push, and I wonder if it's because just the way bands earn money now is so different that they've really got to push album sales.
Well, I mean, they're battling against Spotify for one thing. They're also battling against a load of unscrupulous venues who will take their 20-25% cut of any merchandise sold in the venue at a gig. So that the drive to, you know, try and keep it all within, you know, in house.
Yeah.
I would assume is a lot higher, but maybe it's always been like that. But
because with this as well, you're sort of having, you know, the tie-in is you have to buy the album, then you can, you know, get your ticket for the gig. So, like, again, my friend Maisie, who's going tomorrow, him and his wife and his daughter, between them, they've got five copies of the Idols album.
Yeah.
Because they were just trying to get tickets and get in. So I think it's a good thing, because it's encouraging physical sales, which I love. I love that vinyl over the past few years has really shot back up in its popularity. But also, what I'm really loving about it is that, so Idols, I'm going to go and see them in Halifax, Peace Hall.
Yes.
It's on the same day as my Grace's 18th birthday. And so that's me and her. That's we're going to get ourselves there.
Excellent.
When they play their tour later in the year, they're playing three nights of the Apollo. They played two nights of the Where. This is now a band playing massive venues. So what I'm loving is that fans now, on this sort of resurgence of push, you know, small performances for albums, you know, Maisie's going to get to see them tomorrow night in a smaller venue. You know, one of your favorite bands in a smaller venue playing new tracks.
Yeah, you know. Well, it's so odd that you mentioned this today, because yesterday we just bought tickets for a similar gig. And
really?
It was only because my wife got notified that these tickets were on sale.
Okay.
So it's in Leeds, start of March, maybe this March 7th.
Leeds.
A place called The Wardrobe. 400 capacity. And it's to promote the new album, Volume 4, Jesse, Jacob Collier.
No.
Yeah. Managed to get three tickets yesterday, bought the album and got three tickets. 400
no
capacity.
Way.
So when you see on YouTube, if you haven't heard Jacob Collier, he does these massive choirs with the crowd.
Right,
and
incredible.
And it's really moving, and it's beautiful.
Search out the Glastonbury. Though his one from Glastonbury last year was just mad.
But he's a bit of a musical genius, but he's doing solo piano, lots of tunes from the new album, and then a Q&A at this 400 capacity small venue. And what he did as well was all of the tickets for this, you had to buy an album or... No, actually,
yep.
I think you could buy a single ticket, but you could only buy one ticket. So you couldn't buy seven tickets.
Right. Okay.
But they had packages. And I think the package was, if you bought a ticket for the gig and the CD, it was an extra £3 for the CD.
you know, it was
flipping heck.
Yeah, I mean, it was an extra 30 quid for the vinyl, but you know, vinyl, you know, that's vinyl. But yeah, it was only like 20 quid a ticket.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That's going to be great.
It's good. Well, we've wanted to see him for ages, and my son's massive, massive fan. But he's always been too young to see it because because the last time I think he was in Manchester, he was at the Apollo, and you had to be over 14. And Gabe now could pass for over 14, but at the time he was only 10 or 11, so there was no way that you'd be able to get past it. So, it's fantastic, really excited. But what he's done is he's selling the tickets not through his own website. He's selling the Leeds tickets through Crash Records, an independent record shop. And they sell tickets as well as LPs and CDs and stuff. So supporting local independent business as well. So yeah, knockout. Well chuffed with that.
That's brilliant, and I am, I'm loving this new sort of resurgence of bands and artists doing that. I think it's great, and so get out there, people. Go and buy a physical copy of an album, and go and see, you know, or potentially see a really big artist who plays large venues, play your local HMV or, you know, local Wardrobe in Leeds.
Yeah, Wardrobe. I mean, he's playing the AO Arena in December. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it shows you how small the venue is compared to what he's looking at performing in. So
I love it.
Yeah.
So listener, let us know if you've been to one, if you've got one coming up, who you've seen, and tell us your stories and send us your pictures.
Absolutely. Get in contact with us on Instagram at Gig Stories Pod, on Twitter or X at Gig Stories Pod, email info@gigstoriespodcast.com. But make sure you subscribe to the podcast, you like, and if you like it, even if you don't, just leave a little review. It all helps with the algorithms and the maths, basically. It means more people can find us.
Thank you. We love you. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you soon for another wonderful episode of the Gig Stories podcast. Go, go, bye, bye, bye.
Bye, bye.